Well, good morning and welcome to the Mount. Today we are beginning a new 5-week series titled Catching Foxes. And over the next couple weeks, what we're going to be doing is going through an Old Testament book by the name of Song of Songs. And so whatever campus you are at, if you happen to have downloaded the Mount app, I encourage you to open that up right now, and you can find under the sermon notes section, you can find the notes and the scripture references and a place to take your own notes. If you are here and you brought your own Bible and you want to turn and follow with us, when you go to the table of contents, it may say Song of Songs and it may say Song of Solomon. That is the same thing. So go ahead and turn there. And part of the maybe the discrepancy in the translation that you might be using will depend on how they interpret the first verse of the book. And so I'll just kind of tell you this. The first verse talks about, it's titled, The Song of Solomon, or The Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. And researchers are back and forth on this. Scholar. Some scholars say that that means that it was written by Solomon, so it's his Song of Songs. Other ones would say, no, it's dedicated to Solomon, so it's really just the Song of Songs. And other ones might say, no, it's more of a wisdom book written in the wisdom tradition of Solomon, and so he had nothing to do with it, and so that's why you get the discrepancy back and forth. And so over the next several weeks, as we go through this series, just know I may flip back and forth. I may say Song of Songs. I may say Song of Solomon. Grammatically, they are both correct, and you can say whichever you want as well. Well, while you are turning there, I recognize that across all of our campuses, as a church this size, that we could have a very different maybe context for how we've related to this book. Maybe for some of you, you tried to read the book Song of Songs at one point. And what happened was, as you begin to kind of dive into it, you got kind of halfway through the first chapter and you found some language around stags and gazelles and mares and all these other things, and it got really complicated, and so you sort of just backed up from it for a minute. And that's partly because this book has been interpreted in two main ways throughout church history. And just real quick, the first way it's been interpreted is that the book Song of Songs or Song of Solomon is an allegorical book. It is a poem that is all of this allegorical imagery expressing the love that God has for Israel or the love that Jesus has for his church. And when you read it this way, it's this very meaningful and beautiful book about how much we are loved by God and his son and how broken we are and how we are his bride as the church, and he longs to step into a relationship with us. And that tradition typically has been read more ancient, more maybe the early Roman Catholic Church or the Puritan movement. It has been read kind of in circles of the Christian world where maybe the topics of sex or passion or lust were a little bit too taboo, and so they sort of stepped back from it. The other way to read the book is just to take it for its literal face-to-face value of what it is. It is a love song or a story. It is the Song of Songs, a love song between a man and a woman. And we see them as they passionately begin a dating relationship, as they get engaged, as they have their honeymoon, and as they move into this lifelong pursuit of marriage. And so for context for us over the next 5 weeks, that's how we will read it. We will read it simply as a love story, a love song between a man and a woman, and we will see what God might have to say to us through it. And like I said, maybe you picked this up one time and started reading it and you got really confused. Or maybe you picked it up and you got, you know, a little bit into it, and maybe you came across a verse like in chapter 2 where part of the story, the woman is talking to the man and she's saying that he is outside her window peering through the lattice at the window looking in, and you got there and you thought, man, this guy's a creeper. Someone should warn her. Like, this is a stalker. And you got there and you could have just kind of backed off, right? Or maybe you're here today and you have no context with this book at all. And let me just say, if you are joining us for the first time or you've never read this book before, you are in for a treat, because over the next 5 weeks, I'm just going to say this, is a very spicy book. And when I say spicy, I mean like you're going to blush a little and you're going to want to close it and be like, are we really saying that in church today? And in fact, I'll just kind of throw this right out there. One of my favorite verses from this book is found in chapter 7, where the man, the lover, is writing to the girl, and he compares her slender frame, her figure. He says that she is like a coconut tree or a palm tree, and the coconuts or her breasts are like fruit, and all he wants to do is climb the tree and grab hold of the fruit. It is a verse I have tried to get my wife to memorize over and over and over again. And every man in the room was like, amen, I'm so glad I'm at church today. And so my hope is, as we dive through this, that we see this book in a new way. And so I'll just kind of give you a picture of where we're going over the next couple weeks. And the core verse we're going to use for this series is found in the second chapter, and it's found in verse 15. And in the New Living Translation, it translates this way. The author says, catch all the foxes, those little foxes, before they ruin the vineyard of love, for the grapevines are blossoming. And what's interesting about this verse is in the ancient world, and I don't know if you know this, but even in our modern world, foxes are these little sneaky things. And for us, when we think of foxes, a lot of times we think maybe where you live in Virginia, what part of Northern Virginia, maybe the foxes sneak into your chicken coop or your neighbor's chicken coop or someone on your street's chicken coop and they kill the chickens. But in the ancient world, the thing was less about chickens and the foxes really, really loved grapes. And what you would see is these foxes would sneak into these vineyards and just begin eating and destroying all the grapes, and it would leave the vineyard just demolished where it could produce no fruit. And what the writer of this book is warning you and I as is when it comes to our relationships, our dating relationships, or our marriage relationships, our vineyard, if I could call it that, we need to beware of the little things that can come in and destroy it, the little things that can come in and ruin it. And so over the next couple weeks, here's where we're going. Today's message is titled, The Hunt Begins, and we're talking about attraction. And this idea that when you and I, when we begin to get in a dating relationship, what are the qualities, according to this book, that we should be looking for? And maybe you're already married like I am, and I would say that these very same qualities still apply in your marriage relationship, because these are qualities that you and I should be developing and longing for all of our life in every intimate relationship we have. And next week, we'll see this couple as they begin this idea of the pursuit, where they begin asking the question, now that we are serious and now that we are heading towards marriage, what should we do? How should we live in such a way that our future marriage is honoring God in a secure and safe way? And it will ask us the same question for those of us that are married. How can you and I, as we pursue our spouse continually the same way we did before we were married? And then in week 3, we'll pick up on this couple on their honeymoon night. And we have 2 whole chapters devoted to the honeymoon night. And so just a warning for you men, week 3 will be the topic of sex. So you can go ahead and put it in your calendar now and make sure you get your wife out of bed early that day and you're here ready before everyone else. And we will dive in and talk about this incredible gift that God has given us in the context of marriage and what it looks like for this couple. And then week 4, immediately following their intimacy, they get in a fight. And we'll talk about conflict. We'll talk about how we handle conflict in a healthy way and how we see God work in and through us in conflict. And then week 5, maybe one of my favorite weeks, is we'll talk about this idea that God, for those of us that are married, God doesn't want us to get to year 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 or 30 and just settle. No. When we look at this couple, we see a couple who, for the course of their marriage, is passionately pursuing each other day in and day out, year after year after year. And in fact, that's one of the themes we'll see in this book over and over and over again, is this book is going to ask us a question. And I'll ask the question today. For those of us that are married, the question the book is going to ask is, do you desire your spouse? Not do you like your spouse? Not do you love your spouse? But do you desire your spouse? Do you desire them with the passion and the longing that maybe you once had? Or has the flame fizzled and sort of gone away? And so we'll dive right in. And I do want to say this before we begin, that I know a lot of times in a church our size, when we start talking about dating and marriage and what that looks like, we can come from all different places. And many of us may instinctively begin to feel a little bit of guilt or a little bit of shame and say, man, I wish I could go back and do X differently. I wish I wouldn't have done Y. I wish this would have happened. And I think all of us, regardless of where we are in our life, we all have these things about our past we wish we could change. Or maybe the moment you heard we were doing a series on marriage, you immediately begin to think of all the ways that maybe you're not the best husband. You haven't lived up to the expectation you have for yourself, or you haven't been the best wife you thought you could be, and you immediately are beginning to feel a little guilt and shame. I just want to pause and say my hope is that this series is what I would call maybe a from this day forward type of series. We're not going to spend the next 5 weeks talking about your past. We're not going to talk about what you've done or what you wish you could do or what you wish you could change. No, we're going to talk about what this book shows us as a vision for the future. And I hope, my prayer, my goal, my dream is that you leave here after 5 weeks and you feel empowered, regardless of your past, to live out your dating and marriage relationships the way God has intended you to live it, in a God-honoring and healthy way. And so we'll dive right in. And in chapter 1, verse 2, the lady says this. She says, "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for his love is more delightful than wine." And she just sort of dives right in, right? Like there's no like a gospel of like when Paul's writing and it's like to the brothers. And she's just like, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. In other words, she's like, man, I just want him to kiss me. I just want him to lay kisses all over me. Why? Because she says, "For your love is more delightful than wine." In other words, she says, "I am so in love with you. You are so intoxicating. Your presence and who you are, everything about you, I just want you to wrap me in your arms and kiss me because you are better than getting drunk. You are better than wine. You are that intoxicating." Now, maybe you guys read scripture differently than I do, but when I read this, the first thing I think of, and this is a confession for you, the first thing I think of is, what did this man do to get her so worked up? Like, and where do I take notes on this? And so that's a valid question. What did he do to get her so worked up? What did he do to get her to say, "Let him just kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. I am so in love with him. It's like being drunk." And so she continues in verse 3, and it says this. It says, "Pleasing is the fragrance of your perfumes. For your what?" And I want everyone to say this at all of our campuses. "Your what?" "Your name." "Your name is like what?" "Is like?" "Perfume." "Your name is like perfume poured out. No wonder the young women love you." She says, "Listen, your name is like perfume poured out." Now, perfume was a lot different back in ancient Israel than it is now. The way it is now, it's this, you know, tiny little bottle, and you maybe squirt a little here and squirt a little there or here. I don't know where you squirt perfume, but you squirt it on yourself, and then you go out. But in the ancient Israelites, perfume was this rare, expensive, thick oil. Because what would happen was, even more rare than perfume, was the ability to take a bath. Right? Like they didn't have like adequate showers and bathhouses. Maybe if they were lucky, unless you were incredibly wealthy, the people who were the common class, if they were lucky, maybe once every couple weeks, maybe once a month, they'd be able to have time to go down to the river and bathe in it. But for the most part, they didn't have adequate access to cleanliness and to bathing, to making sure they were clean. So what would happen is if they had some sort of big public event, if they had something they knew they were going to and they wanted to make an impression, they would take this perfume and they would dump a little bit of the oil and begin rubbing it all over their body. And what it would do is not only would the oil smell, but it would cover up the bad smell that was on their natural body odor, if you could say that, I guess. And so, I don't know if you know this, but as human beings, maybe I'm different than you, but as a human being, I know for me, when I walk into someone's house, or when I walk past someone at the grocery store, or when I'm having a conversation with someone, and they smell good, I sort of lean in. Like if I go to someone's bathroom and I'm like, "What's that smell?" And I sort of look around and my nose twitches and I'm wondering what it is. I get a smile on my face. I lean in. I want to know more. I'm interested. But if somebody smells bad, I sort of recoil, right? I sort of step back. I lean in when things are good and lean back when it's bad. The funny thing is we do the same thing with people's names. If I was to say the name Hitler, you immediately would attach a smell to it. What I mean by that is you immediately, without thinking of any specific action, you would immediately know whether you want to lean in or you want to lean back. You would immediately know whether it's going to make you smile or it's going to make you recoil. Why? Because you're not thinking of a specific thing that Hitler did, most likely. Most likely, you're thinking of the all-encompassing character and reputation of who Hitler was. And here's this woman who is so in love and on fire for this man. And she says, "Your name is like perfume." In other words, your character is attractive. Your reputation is good. I want to lean in at sound of your name. Question. Those of you that are in a dating relationship, I know for me, so many times, the very first thing we think of is, does he look good, right? Like, does he work out? Does he have abs? Does his jawline look like it could cut glass? Is he exactly the physical characteristics I want? If we're a male, maybe we're thinking, I wonder how she looks in a bathing suit. I wonder, like, right, we're wondering about the physical attraction, but we see very clearly from this passage in the very beginning is, yes, physical attraction and desire is there, right? She says, let him kiss me. Being attracted is not bad, but from the very beginning, the first thing she wants to know is, does he have good character? Does he have good character? And I don't know where you are in your life, but maybe you are in a season right now where you are dating. And maybe this is a question you need to be asking of every person you consider dating. Do they have good character? What do other people at school say about him? What do people at church say about her? What do my parents think? How does he treat me? How does she treat me? What sort of, are they impatient? Are they kind? Are they gentle? Are they loving? Do they live out the fruits of the Spirit? If I held up their life to the standards that I find in here, would they be someone who matches it, or would they be different? What is their character? What do people around them tend to think and tend to say? And it's funny. Is what's interesting is I talk to people all the time, and they would say, "Man, I know he's not perfect, but I think I can fix him." Listen, if he smells bad now, he's gonna smell bad later. Like, there's not really a kinder way to say that. Like, some of you, in an effort to date her or to date him, you say the Lord has called you to full-time missionary work, where you're willing to go where no one else is going, to step into pagan land and to date them in hopes to bring them to Jesus. Listen, that doesn't work. Why? Because typically when you get involved with someone, your character and your reputation drops to their level. It's easier to pull someone off a chair than it is to pull them up with you. Do they have good character? She continues, and this is key. She says, "No wonder the young women love you." And she says, "Take me away with you. Let us hurry. Let the king bring me into his chambers. For we rejoice and delight in you, and we will praise your love more than wine." Now, let's pause for a second, because this passage doesn't show, but there are three main characters in this book. There is the man, who is the lover. There is the female, the woman, who is the beloved. And then there is her group of friends. And the friends are important, because everyone who grew up in the 90s fully understands that if you want to get with her, you got to get with her friends, right? Like, we all understand that. And everyone who's older is like, I don't know what's happening. But here's what I want you to see in this passage. Is she says, "Take me away with you. Let us hurry. Let the king bring me into his chambers." In other words, she's saying, "I want to go deeper with you." His chamber would have been the most intimate place they could go. I don't think this is a passage about sex yet. Instead, she's saying, "Take me into your inner place. Take me into this intimate VIP access only. Take me into the place where our relationship can go deeper and deeper, deeper than anyone else. I want you to be my soulmate," in essence, if you want to use that language. And then this part, it doesn't show it up here, but the "we" is the friends talking now. And the friends say, "We rejoice and delight in you. We will praise your love more than wine." In other words, she says, "I am so attracted to this man because his name is like oil poured out that I want to go deeper into a relationship with him." And the friends say, "Go for it, because we think his character is good too." And here's what I want you to hear. Character is always, always, always confirmed by others, not just by you. Why does that matter? Because when you begin to fall in love with someone, you can become so infatuated with them that you don't see what others see. And you may say, "Yeah, but they just don't know her the way I do. Like, he really is kind when he's not at work." That's a flag, guys. I'm just You are so blind in your love. What do others say about it? How have they confirmed the reputation and the characteristics that you are looking for? And so just a couple questions I have for us. One, if you are in a dating relationship right now, maybe a question for you to reflect on is, does that person have good character? Does that person's life match Scripture? And I'm not asking, are they Christian? Notice I haven't said that. That's sometimes our go-to, right? Like we're like, oh, they must be safe to date because they said they're Christian. Listen, you can say you are a Christian in 2024 America and live the most grotesquely immoral life of anyone I have ever met. I'm not asking if they are Christian. I'm asking if their life, what they do, the smell of their name, if it resembles and models the life and teachings of Jesus. That's what I'm asking. Is their character founded on this? If it is not, that is the basis of this entire relationship, is he was someone of character. And if you are dating someone who is not someone of character, flee. Now, maybe you're dating or maybe you're not, maybe you're single, and here's a question. How's your character? You see, are you becoming the person that your future spouse is praying for? Maybe a way to think about this question. Are you becoming the person that you want to find in someone else? Because I'll tell you this. If you find yourselves continually attracting someone of the opposite sex who has bad character, it usually means you're fishing with the wrong bait. It usually means that your character might need a little bit of work. Third, for those of us that are married, I don't know about you, but I talk to so many people who they say, we got married, and that person has just been the same ever since. How is your character growing in your marriage? Not how are you making sure you stay fit and toned for your husband or your wife, but how are you exercising spiritual character so that you are a better mate to him or her? She continues, verse 5. She says, what? She says, say this with me. She says, dark am I, yet lovely daughters of Jerusalem. Dark like the tents of Kedar, like the tent curtains of Solomon. Now, I want to pause here because what she is not saying and what some commentators might have you to believe is this is not a racial thing here. She is not saying I'm dark because I came from this other region of the world. No. She is saying I'm dark, and she's reflecting on her skin. This is a literal thing she's talking about. She's saying, I am dark. My skin is dark. And we'll talk about why in just a second. But what's important to understand is she's beginning to express an insecurity. Why? Because in our culture, in 2024 modern American culture, when we think of a female that is attractive or a male is attractive, most likely there's a certain physical profile and they are tan. They have a little bit of a bronze glow to them, right? That's what attracts us. That's what magazines and television and things elevate as the kind of ideal picture. Well, in her culture, pale was in. To be light-skinned, to be pale was what everyone wanted, because if you were tan, that meant that you were not wealthy enough to stay inside. You had to go into the fields and work. And so only the wealthy people who could avoid the sunlight or who could hide under the shade trees, only those people had the pale skin. And that was the ideal. And she's beginning to express this insecurity, saying, listen, I'm a little bit sunburned. I'm a little bit tan. And she continues in verse 6. Check this out. She says, do not what? Do not stare at me. Because I am dark. She says, because I am darkened by the sun. For my mother's sons, I don't know why she doesn't just say my brothers, but my mother's sons were angry with me and made me take care of the vineyards. My own vineyard I had to what? To, now, this is so important. She says, listen, don't, she's expressing her insecurity. She says, don't stare at me. Don't stare at me because of my skin. I know I'm a little tan. I know I'm sunburned. I know this is not the proper ideal appearance that I should have, but it's not really my choice. I had to go work in the vineyards because my brothers were so mad at me. They made me go out into work. And not only did I have to go into work, I had to work so much that I couldn't take care of my own vineyard. And otherwise, because I was working in the fields, I couldn't take care of my own body. My hair is unkempt. My clothes are dirty. They may be torn. They may be ragged. Don't look at me because I know I am not that attractive. She says, don't look at me. I'm not that attractive. And here's what I want you to see. As their relationship begins to grow and mature, you see this woman, as they're growing and maturing, beginning to open up and express more and more vulnerability and insight and insecurity. And I think that's a question for all of us that are in a dating relationship. The person that you are dating, are they someone that you can trust? Are they someone that you can trust? And what I mean by that is not trust that they're going to show up to a certain place when they say they're going to show up. That's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about when you confess your vulnerabilities to someone, and we all experience this, you open up, you share something, and you leave that conversation, and one of two things pops into your mind. You leave that conversation after sharing and opening up, and you leave it and you say, man, I feel so much better. I'm glad I told that to them. Or you leave and you think, did I say a little bit too much? That might have been too far. And let me just say, if you are dating someone and you are proud of their character and you are growing in a relationship deeper and deeper, but every time you are vulnerable and open, if you walk away wondering, did I share too much? Was that too much? That's probably because deep down in your soul, and you don't want to admit it, you don't trust that person because they're not someone who is shepherding your heart the way it should be shepherded. Can you trust them? Is it someone that you can trust? For those of us that are already in a marriage relationship, I don't know if you know this, but your spouse is not perfect. Right? Like, if you're sitting next to them, you can look over at them. And right now, just be like, you're not perfect. That's okay. They're probably thinking the same thing about you already. So, but here's what I want you to see. Every single one of us comes into a marriage relationship with baggage and hurt and pain and insecurity. And our jobs as husband and wife is to be the image of Christ to them in such a way that we shepherd and love them in and through their insecurities. We don't get annoyed when they struggle with the same thing over and over and over again. Are you someone your spouse can trust? Are you someone when they open up with you, they don't leave thinking, man, I wish I wouldn't have told my wife that? You need to be someone they can trust. Verse 7, it continues. It says, tell me, you whom I love, where you graze, this is still the woman speaking, where you graze your flock and where you rest your sheep at midday. Why should I be like a what? Why should I be like a veiled woman beside the flocks of your friends? Now, this is an interesting wordplay she uses here. And so I recognize that there might still be some kids in the room even after the palm tree and the fruit joke. And so when she is saying, should I be like a veiled woman was a woman who would go into relationships with men for a price and perform duties and then be done with the relationship. And so, in essence, what she is saying is she's saying, as I'm learning to trust you more, as my relationship, and don't miss this, as my relationship is growing deeper with you, to have you, to fully be invested, what does she say? I won't do what those women do. In other words, she says, I have standards. I have standards. And I'm not going to do what they do. And I don't care how much I love you, how much I like you, I will not compromise my moral and my values and my standards just to get you the way other people would. And maybe a question for you, if you were in a dating relationship and you are evaluating, is this person someone that you want to continue with? Maybe the question you need to ask is, do they have biblical standards? Do they have biblical standards? And what I mean by that specifically for context of the passage, and then I'll unpack why it matters, the context of this passage is referring to the way God has created and designed sex in our world. And we'll talk about this in week 3, but sex is a really, really good thing. It's not a bad, dirty thing that we need to avoid and never talk about. Sex is a gift from God, but it is only a gift from God for one context, and that is the marital relationship between a man and a woman who have covenanted and committed together for all of their life. Anything outside of that would be what God's word would say is sin. Now, we'll talk about that in week 3. Here's why it matters for today's context, though, is because, I don't know if you know this, But a lot of times when you're dating someone and they say, yeah, I know that's what it says, but man, that was like 1,000 years ago. And they begin to compromise on one thing found in here. What's to say they won't compromise on 2 or 3 or 4 things? And listen, not always, but most of the time, if someone is willing to compromise over and over and over again before marriage, what makes us think that all of a sudden they will stop compromising in the future when their marriage is not going the way it should be going? Do they have standards? They matter. And this woman says, I won't do what the others are doing. Why? Because she doesn't want what others have. She wants something better. And let me just say, Mount Church, if you are here and you are single, I don't want you to experience what others have. I want you to experience what God has for you. Something so much better, so much more holy, and so much more pure. And lastly, a question to ask yourselves in your dating relationships is, do they build you up? Do they build you up? Remember, she's feeling insecure about her skin and her appearance. And what does he say, verse 9? This is the first time he talks to us. So he says, I liken you, my darling, to a what? To a mare among Pharaoh's chariot horses. This dude does not know how to pillow talk. I mean, listen, she just spent how many verses? I want you to kiss me with your mouth. Your love is more intoxicating than wine. You're amazing. You're beautiful. Your character is like oil poured out. Your name is incredible. And your physique. And she's complimenting all these things about him. And he comes back and says, you, my darling, are like a horse. I mean, guys. So here's what she's saying, or here's what he's saying. A mare is a specific type of horse. It was an adult female horse that was white. Its coat was white. And in ancient Egyptian culture, because he's talking about Pharaoh's chariots, in ancient Egyptian culture, when they would have all these military processions, you know, they would have all these soldiers and all these chariots, and then would come Pharaoh. And the only horses that were allowed in the entire ancient kingdom to pull Pharaoh's chariots were adult white female horses. And so in essence, is he is saying to her, you are special. You are one of a kind. In fact, you are so good that you're not even worthy to be around those other things. You see, for ancient Egyptians, they thought that the horses that pulled the chariot or the Pharaoh were almost godlike. They were heavenly. And so he is giving her this incredible compliment, telling her about how perfect she is. And then they both sort of do this back and forth, and you'll see this on the screen behind me. He says to her, your cheeks are beautiful with earrings and your neck with strings of jewels, and we will make you earrings of gold studded with silver. And she says to him, while the king was at his table, my perfume spread its fragrance. My beloved to me is a sachet of myrrh resting between my breasts. I don't know what that is, but I want to be one, right? Verse 14, it says, my beloved to me is a cluster of henna blossoms from the vineyards of En-Gedi. And he says, how beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. Your eyes are doves. And she says, oh, how handsome you are, my beloved. Oh, how charming. And our bed is verdant. And he says, the beams of our house are cedars and our rafters are fir. And there's just this back and forth, encouraging one thing after another, back and forth. And it sounds like two people sitting on a beach just whispering love poems for each other, right? And then she says this, look at chapter 2, verse 1-2. She says, I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys. And when we read this, we think a rose of Sharon is this incredibly rare rose. No. In her common ancient Israel world, the rose of Sharon was just a common country wildflower. In essence, she's saying, listen, I know you're pouring into these words of affirmation to me, but I'm just a common girl. I'm just like everyone else. I'm just somebody in a valley, a common wildflower. And he says, look what he says. No. You are like a lily among the thorns. You are like a lily among the thorns. She says, I'm just a common flower among all these other common flowers. And he says, no, you are You are a flower and everyone else is an ugly thorn. You are that special and you are that good. And I love you that much. Now, words are powerful, aren't they? I don't know if you know this, but the old, you know, elementary school thing of like sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me is just complete garbage, right? Like we read in the book of Proverbs in the Old Testament that our words have the power of life or death. We read in the New Testament book of James that our words, our tongue is so powerful that animals can be driven by it. We're told that our words, our tongue is so powerful that it's like a match in a dry wildfire sparking and igniting. We're told in Ephesians 4:29 that we're to let nothing, because our words are so powerful, we're to let nothing unwholesome come from our mouth. We're only to say what edifies and builds up and helps and points people back to the person and the work of Jesus Christ. Our words have power. They have immensity about them. And what I want you to understand is that there is no other relationship in your life besides your marriage where your words have such tremendous impact. The things you say shape the person that you are married to. And I don't know if you understand this or not, but I talk to people in my office, couples all the time, who might be really honest with each other and say, man, I don't like what she does. I don't like who he is. And they're at each other and they're frustrated and they're bitter. And I want to tell them over and over again, listen, if you don't like what you see in your spouse, maybe step back and evaluate what you're saying to your spouse. Because your words, if you're tearing her down, she will live at your words. If you are building him up, he will live at your words. Words matter. So a question, if you are in a dating relationship right now, does that person build you up? If not, run. In your marriage, are you building up or tearing down? And here's what I love about this. Is this woman, like, look what happens when the man speaks these words of encouragement to her. In verse 3 of chapter 2, it says this. It says, and this is her talking, like an apple tree among the trees of the forest is my beloved among the young men. So, like, he's strong and he's powerful. And she says, I delight to sit in his what? Say this with me. Let's try this again. I delight to sit in his. Now, we're going to come back to that. I delight to sit in his shade, and his fruit is sweet to my taste. Why is this so important? Because what was her insecurity? Her skin and being in the sun. She didn't want to be in the sun. She didn't want it because that meant that she wasn't as pretty and wasn't as beautiful. And in chapter 1, you see her talking about all of her insecurities, all the things she's not good at. At the beginning of chapter 2, she's leaning into him a little more. And then they have this back and forth, this encouragement. And all of a sudden, because he cherishes her, he adores her, he loves her, he speaks words of encouragement into her, watch what happens to her. She comes alive. Look at this in this next verse. It says, let him lead me to the banquet hall. Don't keep me in private. She's fine going out in public now. Take me to the finest places you can. I don't care what my skin like. Take me there and let his banner over me be love. Strengthen me with raisins, which were an aphrodisiac. She's saying she is physically turned on and attracted to him right now. Refresh me with apples, for I am faint with love. His left arm is under my head and his right arm embraces me. Don't miss this. I love this. She is suffering from insecurity over her skin, and she says, because of his words of encouragement, he shades me. He protects me. He watches over me. And when he speaks words of encouragement that protect me, her response is to come alive. And she says, man, his hand is like this, and he's like this, and we're about to, you know. Husbands, you want your wife to come alive? Speak words of encouragement. Build her up. Wives, you want to see your man stand tall and proud? Build him up. Point out his good, not his flaws. If you're in a dating relationship and you walk away from those conversations with that person and you feel less than you did before, they're not building you up. Because God has intended marriage to bring you alive and the good to come out of you. And that only happens in Christ with the words and affirmations of another. Let's pray. Jesus, we are so thankful for your word. God, we ask, we beg that as we dive into this book, you would use this couple to shape and mold our relationships. God, we are so thankful for the good news that comes from this chapter. And as we continue praying, I just want to share this. This is the good news of this chapter, is that you and I are the woman. We are insecure. We are broken. We are less than we think we should be. And Jesus is the lover who comes in and lifts us up and builds us up and encourages us and sets us free to live life abundantly. It is in Jesus and Jesus alone that you and I come alive. And maybe you are here today and you would say, Adam, I am broken and I am hurting. And I feel less than and insecure, like I'm not good enough in this area or this walk of my life. And what I want to tell you is that Jesus wants to come into your life and make you new and bring you alive. And all you have to do is believe. And so this morning at all of our campuses, if you want to surrender your life to Jesus and to trust in his love and his embrace, would you just be bold with our eyes closed and heads bowed and slip up your hand right where you are? Jesus, I need your love. I see your hand. I see your hand. If you raised your hand, I want you to pray this prayer with me. Father, I am a sinner. Jesus, come into my life. Make me new. Be my king.